I'm Marty Mosco, and welcome to Radio Times. It's been a busy few weeks for Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter. On May 12th, an Amtrak passenger train derailed in the city, killing 8 people and disrupting the Northeast Corridor. The mayor was the face and the voice of the city dealing with this horrifying tragedy and its aftermath. A week later, former city councilman Jim Kinney blew away the competition in his bid to be the Democratic nominee for mayor. And in this heavily Democratic town, he's almost guaranteed the job. At a press conference last week, Nutter and Kinney, who disagree on key issues, admitted they could both be pains in the neck, although their language was a bit saltier. We asked Mayor Nutter to talk about the campaign and the results and to talk about his tenure in office, including what he wants to do in the remaining months. And Mayor Nutter, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Thanks, Marty. Always good to be here.
Always good to have you with us. And I just wanted an update on those people that were injured in this Amtrak accident that happened in Philadelphia. Can you give us a status report on them?
A little bit. Trying to certainly be sensitive and respectful to the families. And again, we lost 8 souls that night, and our hearts are broken. And our prayers and thoughts remain with those families. I've talked to family members from each of the 8 families, and just express on behalf of the city directly our condolences to them. But very, very hard. Yeah. At the same time, it's amazing that 235 people survived what was just a horrendous wreckage out there. And, saw just yesterday at Memorial Day services, Patrick Murphy, he was on that train.
That's right.
I spoke at University of Pennsylvania School of Design commencement about a week or so ago. There was a graduating student who was on that train.
Wow.
But a number of others still in hospitals, injured, pretty serious situations for some. The NTSB is the National Transportation Safety Board, is the lead agency for the investigation. Their investigations typically take about a year to get to the real bottom line of what happened. We still don't know why the train was going so fast into that curve, and preliminary reports show that it actually accelerated going into the curve. We don't know any more with regard to the train engineer, the person who actually drives the train. So we'll wait and see what the results are. In the meantime, Amtrak has upgraded the positive train control service for northbound.
That particular track?
On that particular track area. The FRA, Federal Railroad Administration, has made other orders with regard to Amtrak service. And all the transportation agencies, rail carriers rather, are supposed to have this security device in place. SEPTA actually is one of the leading agencies to get that done. And reports seem to indicate that most railroad agencies will not have it in place by the end of 2015 because of, bandwidth and spectrum kinds of issues. But again, Philadelphians responded so immediately, so quickly, and so warmly and kindly to this tragedy. And that's a reflection on the city of brotherly love and sisterly affection. So to all Philadelphians, thank you for your commitment.
Are you pleased with how the city responded, how your administration responded? Did it do what you wanted it to do?
Yes, and that credit goes to Everett Gillison, our deputy mayor for public safety, and my chief of staff, people like Desiree Peterkin-Bell, our city representative, director of communications, developing the strategy for how we communicated with the public, Rich Negrin, our managing director, and Sam Phillips, who is our director of the Office of Emergency Management, and Mike Resnick, our director of public safety. I mean, those individuals and so many more, Police Commissioner Ramsey, Fire Commissioner Derek Sawyer, the SEPTA police, the Amtrak as an agency, state police. Governor Wolf was here almost every day from the day of the tragedy till the reflection service that we had. So all the agencies performed in a superior fashion, and by just sheer coincidence, the day before, that Monday, the day before the Tuesday night accident, we had had a training exercise in mass casualty incidents. And actually, some of our workforce thought that Tuesday was an extension of the Monday training exercise. Yeah. quickly realized that it was not, and this was a serious and real incident. But they did a spectacular job. Again, police officers, firefighters, first responders going into a darkened area. You can barely see. You don't know what has actually happened. You know, was it a bomb? Was it some act of terrorism? Was it something else? And they just didn't hesitate and save lives that night. Our hospitals and all across the area took in patients, again, not knowing what the real circumstance or situation was. They saved lives that night as well. So from an operations standpoint, superior response. And we've received acknowledgement. President Obama, when he came to town, actually was going to Camden but flew into Philadelphia, wanted to meet our top emergency response personnel, complimentary Vice President Biden, and a number of others. So all across the country, I think people are looking at the way we responded. They acknowledge and know that some people died, but they also know that a lot of people lived, and it was because of the superior response by Philadelphia to this tragedy.
I mentioned the fact that Jim Kenney won the Democratic nomination for mayor of Philadelphia.
Sure.
You didn't endorse anyone in this particular race.
I didn't.
Are you pleased, even when you look at how he was able to get votes across many of the sort of divisions within the city, that he was able to do that and win?
Well, first and foremost, certainly congratulations to him for his win in the Democratic primary, and to Melissa in the Republican primary. I mean, there is still an election. There's still a race. But now speaking more as a Democrat, I did not endorse in the race, primarily because I really thought that, you know, the voters needed the opportunity without, quote-unquote, the mayor weighing in. But the voters should have had the opportunity to fully evaluate the various candidates and hear what they have to say and what's their vision for the future and why do you think, as a candidate, you should be mayor. And in many races in recent times, mayor's races, actually the mayor has not gotten involved for whatever reason. And I just felt that I should keep doing my job. I'm going to vote like every other voter. But Councilman Kenney demonstrated a broad base of support in what I would say is a diverse city with many constituencies and many interests. And he was able to pull all of those various interests together based on his work, based on his record, which I've seen. We came into council together in 1992.
St. Joe's Prep together.
He's a year younger than me, which he often reminds people. But, you know, we've had a working relationship for a long, long period of time. And, yes, two guys who are passionate about this city, who have very strong views and ideas from time to time, we've had some disagreements. But I think, as he articulated at our get-together last week, you know, all of us have different ways of expressing ourselves. The past is the past. And on behalf of this city, it's really important that we move forward. I'm obviously supporting him to win. And it's my duty and responsibility as the mayor and our administration to make sure that when there is a mayor-elect, that we do everything we can to have the smoothest transition possible.
When this goes back to the campaign, then I want to move on to some other issues. Anthony Hardy Williams, senator from Pennsylvania, said that if he became the mayor of Philadelphia, he would fire the police commissioner, Charles Ramsey. And you said he's probably not smart enough to be the mayor.
Well,
you
Martin,
stand by that?
What I said was anyone who was not smart enough to at least ask Police Commissioner Ramsey to stay is probably not smart enough to run this city.
But that was directed at him.
It was directed at anyone who was not smart enough to at least ask Commissioner Ramsey to stay. That's who it was directed at. If the shoe fits, wear it. So I think, and it was in a context of, so right before that, I said, I think one of the smartest things that I did was to ask Commissioner Ramsey to come here, and we know his record and his results. He's acknowledged by the President of the United States as one of the best police commissioners in the country. He's acknowledged by his peers, other police commissioners, to be one of the best in the country. So it just seems to me it'd be a smart thing to do. At least ask him to stay. He'll decide ultimately what he wants to do with his life. He's been a law enforcement person. He's been a police officer for 46-plus years. So he actually knows his work.
Again, I mean, Anthony Hardy Williams said it, and you said
it
in response.
I mean, you know, in a live debate, if look, I am a tremendously loyal person to my people. I asked Commissioner Ramsey to come here. I asked him to stay. He's done an incredible job. Our homicide rate is at the lowest since 1967. Our Part 1 crimes, all the violent crimes, the lowest in 30 years. He's transformed much of the culture of policing here in our city. And again, we're not perfect, and we have moments where people do things that are not right. They get fired. Sometimes they come back. People get prosecuted. Some go to jail, whatever the case may be. So we are not perfect in that regard. But he is great at what he does. And if someone attacks one of my folks, I am going to respond. That's just the way I am. People know me for that. You can talk about me. You can criticize me. I ran for office. They didn't run for office. They're doing their jobs at a superior level. And if you come at one of my folks, you can best be sure I'm coming back at you.
I want to move on to another issue. And you mentioned the fact that there is a Republican candidate for mayor. You're the Democrat. This is a highly Democratic town.
It is.
Is that bad for Philadelphia to be a one-party town? There was a time when it was largely a Republican town.
Yeah, I
mean, have a real competition for this very important job.
Well, I mean, there will be an election. And, the two elections in 99 and 2003 were pretty competitive elections between the Democrat and Republican Party. So, I mean, a part of that is about, you know, who's the candidate? What does the candidate have to offer? There will be an election. Councilman Kennedy and I talked about this last week. I mean, it's a bit of a challenge. You know what the numbers are. You know what the history is, et cetera, et cetera. But out of respect to the public and on behalf of the citizens of the city, you still have to run a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
There's no coronation here. And so people still want to hear from you. But at the same time, how do you best use the 5-6 months in between the primary and the general election, especially if you have a fairly decent chance, and Councilman Kennedy has more than a fairly decent chance of winning in November, but you still have to put on a campaign and you have to think about governing at the same time, at least with the thought in the back of your mind, I could actually win.
Mm.
You don't want to wait until November. The time between November and inauguration is a sprint. Use this time, especially through the course of the summer into the fall, to start thinking about how do you want to govern? Who would you want to serve with you? How do you want to set up your government? But that, I think, has to be a very private, off-to-the-side kind of thing because you are still a candidate. You still have to run an election and have to win.
And we're almost up in a break here. Has he approached anyone in your office about, for instance, staying on when he becomes mayor?
Well, he's publicly said that he would certainly be interested in Police Commissioner Ramsey staying. He's talked about Amy Curlin, our Inspector General, and there may be others. But those are two that I know have been mentioned publicly.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our
We have a lot of great people in the administration.
And I do want to talk about all of that. Mayor Nutter is our guest on Radio Times today. He's been the mayor of Philadelphia for just about 8 years. He's in the last couple of months in office, still much to do on his to-do list. He wants to make sure you know that. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the Facebook and also for Twitter and also for email. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. If you're just joining us, our guest is Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter. We've been talking about the horrific Amtrak passenger derailment that happened earlier this month. Also, the results of the Democratic mayoral primary on May 19th. And he's going to be with us for another 20 minutes or so before we have to say goodbye to him. And the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. I just want to read a couple of Facebook comments for you, Mayor Nutter. One from Robert saying, Mayor Nutter has been a great city leader, level-headed, compassionate, and strong. A tweet from Nate. I applaud the mayor and the police, firemen, medical personnel for their swift response to the train derailment. Then he's got another question, which I will raise as well. But I just wanted to make sure that you knew that there are some fans in the Radio Times audience.
That's always appreciated.
You were telling me during the break that you are not ramping down, but you are actually ramping up. There's seven months left on your term here in Philadelphia.
Well, there are a lot of exciting things going on in Philadelphia, but things that we are directly and actively engaged in as an administration. So, I mean, we're at the tail end of May here, but first weekend in June, of course, is our international bike race, which is upgraded this year to be a part of the Women's World Cup Series. series, first time ever, and the only city added to this entire world tour. That's the first week in June. July, of course, we own the 4th of July here in Philadelphia. So Wawa Welcome America, July 4th, the largest free outdoor concert in the United States of America. I'll be making an announcement later today about that. Made in America is in August. That, of course, is Jay-Z and the Made in America Festival. World Meeting of Families in September.
Pope Francis decided
he wanted to come and check out Philadelphia, bring about a million plus of his best friends with him. That's September. October, Forbes 30 Under 30, coming back to Philadelphia. This is the return engagement. In later that same month, the National Constitution Center's Liberty Medal, which I'm not at liberty to talk about much, but that's going to be a very exciting announcement. November, of course, brings the marathon, as well as around about that time, the Marian Anderson Awards. Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, the Mummers, and then the inauguration. We've got a full summer and fall of Dilworth Park and all the programming that's going to go on there. So we have a very, very busy and active 7 months. Those are just the things that I can remember off the top of my head.
Well, and obviously a busy 7 months for you. Are you, though, at a position in your career here or your job here in Philadelphia where you're beginning to look back on what you have accomplished or what you wish you could have accomplished?
You know, I do from time to time, certainly when I'm asked. I'm usually much more focused on the future. You know, I think when folks think about our time at a later point in time, what I would want to stand out is the fact that the city is a safer place today than it was when I became mayor. The stories, I think there's an editorial in today's paper, and there was a story last week about the improvements in high school graduation rate and the investments that we've made in education here in the city during our last four or five years, $362 million of new money going into schools, the largest ever in the last 30 years. We've made the city more sustainable, economic development, and business friendly. You see about $8.5 billion worth of economic activity going on around the city right now, and we've put people to work. The city is a more ethical place because of the great work of Amy Curlin and certainly Joan Markman and now Hope Caldwell, the Inspector General, and our two Chief Integrity Officers. And so those are the things that I talked about. Philadelphia is on the national, international stage and talked about in ways that we had not been a topic of conversation, at least in a positive way. Sustainability, energy efficiency, our dominance in education and medicine and life sciences and pharmaceuticals. The fact that more and more companies are coming to Philadelphia. So, I mean, those are some of the things that have happened over time. But, you know, for me, it's always about the future and making sure that the city is in better shape than it was when I arrived. I think that's true.
When the primary was in full gear, the number one topic of conversation was schools, you know, whether to keep what we have and should be, obviously, because schools are so critical to life in the city and also
Absolutely.
The future of the city as well. Do you think there's an over expectation about what the mayor of Philadelphia can do in terms of reforming, changing, improving schools? You get to nominate or, I guess, appoint two people to the School Reform Commission, but you don't have that kind of direct involvement.
Here's the thing. So generally, right or wrong, many, many people in Philadelphia think that the mayor is in charge of everything. Even at other levels of government. The mayor should be able to make the state people do what he or she wants them to do. The mayor should be able to make the federal people do what he or she wants them to do and take care of everything in the city, whether it's in your jurisdiction or not. So, I mean, you just have to accept that as a part of the deal with the citizens. Many other people do recognize that the mayor might have some limitations from time to time. So my position was I may not be directly in charge of schools, but they're my children. And I feel an accountability and a responsibility to them and to their parents and to this city. And so, you know, I'm not going to let I was not going to let, you know, what different statutes say get in the way of the fact that if my children are not getting a high quality education, our city is not going to grow. It's not going to function. It's not. I mean, there's no future without a solid base of education. So, I mean, I've talked about the need for funding for education and support for education virtually every day in almost every speech I give. And so, you know, whether I'm directly in charge of it or not, I have taken a level of responsibility and put some accountability there. And I think that has helped to drive the system and the conversation and raise the awareness in the public. I mean, there is something to that thing that people call the bully pulpit. You're the mayor of the fifth largest city in the United States of America. When you have something important to say, most of the time, people will actually pay attention and listen. And so you have to help drive. I mean, I didn't raise the taxes by myself. I don't even have a vote. That's because of leadership over in city council. Council members vote. The state general assembly votes. The governor can propose whatever the governor proposes. But so you have to drive an agenda. And my agenda has been focused on children, their education, and public safety. And so you can do something about these things that you're not directly in charge of. Our college degree attainment rate has gone up. I convene the presidents of the colleges and universities in Philadelphia and the region. Now, clearly, I'm not in charge, but we created the Returning to Learning program that gives a 25% discount to all of our public employees, a spouse, and any dependent children who want to go back to school. So, again, that's a leadership issue, and you can help drive an agenda by collaboration and partnership.
Well, the city has been able, I think, with your help and the help of others, to get more money to the school district in Philadelphia. This district still needs more money.
Absolutely.
You've offered a you know, changes in the property tax,
I guess
an increase in the property tax to get them more money.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like you have a lot of takers for that, at least not yet.
I mean, you know, that was at the March budget address, and I'm well aware, obviously, that council members were running for reelection and a mayor's race, but the children can't wait. And so what we need, what Dr. Hyde asked for, was $105 million of new money that is annually recurring, sustainable, dependable funding that's going to be there year after year after year. And so, you know, the members, election's over. The public is still waiting. The children are still waiting. And so we need to come up with a plan that responds to the $105 million request that is annually recurring, sustainable, and dependable funding, and not damage city services or the city's general fund.
So it's property tax, or I mean, that's the sort
that's
of,
what that's I've proposed.
Okay.
If there are other ideas out there, more than willing to listen and evaluate them. But I also want to see the details behind the numbers, and do they add up? $105 million of annually recurring, dependable, sustainable funding that does not damage city services or take money from the general fund is what we're looking for and what the school children of this city need.
And that's Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter, our guest on Radio Times today. And we're talking, all of a sudden, I was still in Jamaica. What can
right,
I say?
There you go. Yes, you're back in Philly.
I am back in Philly.
But you're at Radio Times.
Thank you very much. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments for our mayor? I mean, I think anyone that lives or works in Center City, Philadelphia, will tell you that this is a very different city than it was, you know, a decade ago or even a couple of years ago. But it's still a city with this high rate of poverty.
Yes.
And while that, I think there have been a number of efforts to try to address that, that high rate of poverty, about 25%, really has not budged.
Well, a couple years ago it was at 28%. So it's come down a couple points, but nowhere near where it should be. And the reality, unfortunately, is that our poverty rate has been above 20% for the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. So it is intergenerational and unfortunately has locked some people into poverty, which again, go back and say that's why education is so important for our children, as well as workforce development and literacy skills for our adults. The path out of poverty is a high-quality education. It is the ability to get a job. It is the ability to take care of yourself. And so, again, that's why I've been so passionate and so focused on that issue. But high-quality education, leading a person to getting a job, also helps reduce crime, helps to reduce unemployment. I mean, so education really has to be the centerpiece of all of those various strategies. And I said this, I believe, either at the inauguration or certainly thereafter, the first inauguration, That education is our anti-crime strategy. It's our anti-poverty strategy. It's our unemployment strategy. It's our literacy strategy. And so, again, educating our young people and making sure that adults, people who are out of school age time, but who are getting good job training, have the opportunity. I work with Councilman Heenan to create the manufacturing task force. We're bringing manufacturing back to the city of Philadelphia. And you don't necessarily have to have a four-year degree to get some of those jobs. The IT world, you don't have to have a four-year bachelor's degree in many instances to get good work in those areas. The skilled trades, and so career and technical education programs. You see what's going on at the A. Philip Randolph School, training young people in a variety of careers. My wife's work with Philadelphia Academies, with a career academy track that we see in so many schools across the city of Philadelphia. And so getting young people ready for the world of work. That's why an internship, a summer job, our 10,000 summer job effort is, again, getting young people focused on what their future could be and exposing them to the world of work. So if there are some employers listening, we need your help in terms of summer job opportunities for young people. So all of these efforts, there's no one thing. I mean, the incredible thing about this job is, A, no day is ever the same as any other day. B, the schedule is an estimate of what might happen today. But C, there are so many opportunities to do so many great and good things to help people in the city. And when you come from a background and an experience of trying to be a servant for others, be a man for others, Jesuit training, there's just nothing better than knowing that your work on the ground, that's what's so great about local government, you can actually help to change and improve people's lives and see that work play out right in front of you.
There, as you know, a number of young people that have moved into the city and they're working and they're establishing
great
businesses.
Great millennial population.
Great millennial population, but oftentimes when they begin to have children, they have this difficult decision.
Sure.
Many of them committed to the city saying, we want to live here, we want our children to go to school here, but for some, they feel like they can't take the
Marty, every day, some parent or parents are sitting around the table saying, you know, Johnny, Sally are 2 years old. Where are they going to kindergarten or where are they going to first grade? And for many, they really want public school to be that option. And they have a school maybe right down the street. We have to make sure that the local school is a true educational option with a high-quality program. And the one of the primary ways to do that, it's not the only way, but it's certainly a big component of it, is having the right number of teachers in that school, the right number of support staff, the right number of counselors, nursing services, noontime aides, all of those elements, after-school programs and AP courses as the students get older. They cost money. And what Dr. Hutt has put forward with Action Plan 3.0 and the fact that this year the debate is not just one about trying to fill a deficit, but actually for the first time in a few years, the discussion about making investments in those areas. That's what this money is for. This new calculator that we have up on the city's website where people can see, you know, what the impact of the property tax would be on their individual home.
Right.
How much is it a year, a month, a week, a day?
This is but the 8.9% or whatever property.
9.34%. But also what their local neighborhood school would use that new money for, between what I've proposed and what Governor Wolf has proposed, to see how many more teachers would they be able to have, or how many more school supplies would they be able to buy, or those kinds of things. I mean, that's what this is really all about. And I don't know how we as adults, successful adults in public office, can in good conscience deny these young people the opportunity to get a great education. And so, look, the election, the primary at least is over. Most council members are well on their path to being reelected. Some don't even have opponents. You're as far away from your next real election as possible. Let's do the right thing by way of our children and give them the resources that they need. A little less about politics, all about people.
Well, let me ask you about your relationship with city council. And Jim Kinney seemed to indicate that he wanted to have a different, maybe more collaborative relationship with city council if/when he becomes mayor of Philadelphia. Do you think you need some improvement on that front?
I need improvement in so many different areas. Your program is not long enough. But every mayor, every executive wants to have a positive working relationship with their legislative body. there are moments, and it has happened to every living mayor, former mayor, going from Mayor Green to Mayor Good to Mayor Street, to Mayor Rendell to Mayor Street, to myself. There are moments, there are situations, there are occasions where you have a difference of opinion, and there'll be some cross talk back and forth, or some actions that play out in the public that none of us are particularly proud of. I think if you look at our overall record together, we fixed the damaged, broken property assessment system here in the city. We've put together, I didn't do it by myself, $362 million of new money into educating our children. We rewrote together the zoning code for the city of Philadelphia and a number of other major achievements. And so for all the chatter out there and all the noise out there about, well, they didn't do this, they didn't do that, most of the things that we've set up to the city council have actually come through the body with a collaboration and a partnership. Yes, there have been some missteps along the way. I'll take responsibility for those. But again, the things that we've accomplished, we didn't do by ourselves, and it came as a result of partnership with city council.
And we're almost out of time. I know you have to go somewhere. Any advice for the next mayor of Philadelphia?
It's all about people. Both, of course, the citizens of the city, but also the folks that you're going to work with. And so the transition becomes critically important. Having well-qualified, highly focused, extremely loyal people in the mayor's administration. It can't be a whole lot of friends and other folks who are just looking for work. That doesn't mean that, I mean, there are people that I knew before. My chief of staff, I went to college with him. My previous chief of staff, went to college with him. But these are positions that on your darkest days, I mean, you're going to need to know that those folks have your back and they're focused on serving the public. And so, again, any advice or support that I can provide, I've already offered that to the councilman, and we'll do the same with Melissa.
Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The internet can be a scary place, an anonymous haven for stalkers and for people who want to threaten and harass others, particularly women. Our guest, Daniel Citron, says it's time to take these attacks seriously, just the way harassment at the workplace was a few decades ago. She's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, wrote a book last year called Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, and contributed a chapter to a new book called Privacy in the Modern Age. She's speaking at the National Constitution Center across the street here from WHYY at noon today and joins us on Radio Times. Daniel Citron, nice to actually meet you.
I know. It's great to see you in person.
Absolutely. Reading both of, having interviewed you on hate crimes in cyberspace and even reading through this new book, Privacy in the Modern Age, I had this kind of nostalgia for what the internet was supposed to be. This place where people could exchange ideas and create this very democratic environment for people.
Right, where we could be our best selves and we were sort of separated from all the things that hold us back when we're face-to-face with people, whether it's our gender, the color of our skin. The notion was, like, behind a computer, we can create ourselves in these really generative ways. But I think what we've seen is, of course, the more we're identifiable online and the more we rely on these tools when we have to rely on them for our jobs, right, for our social lives, the notion that we were somebody else, somewhere else, is of course dissipated. And we realize these network tools are just a part of our lives. They're with us wherever we are. And in order to get a job, we need to have a sort of truthful and robust online presence, which stalkers and harassers try to deprive people of.
I mean, it does raise questions about privacy. I mean, this new book, Privacy in the Modern Age, privacy has an interesting history, but also there's some questions about what it is today.
That's right. I mean, I think so often you hear this trope that privacy is dead and we don't care about it. But I think, you know, we know that public opinion belies that, right? That people, recent Pew report found that people really care about privacy. That includes young people and, you know, folks who are older. We care about privacy. We jealously guard it. There are some things we don't want others to know. And I think some of the recent sort of EU decisions on the right to be forgotten help reintroduce.
In Europe, yes.
Right. Like reintroduce the fact that we have, or we desire, some sort of ways in which we can amend our online reputations and revise, because we're constantly projects of revision, just as human beings. And I think the right to be forgotten, we have a limited one in the United States in very select circumstances, but it helps us kind of reintroduce the value of privacy and ways in which we want to and possibly can reinvent ourselves, hopefully.
How common are things like cyber stalking and harassment? I mean, when you read about it, it's very chilling. I mean, there is, I guess, the anonymity of the internet that allows people to say outrageous and scary things.
Yeah, no, it's much more common than I think most people realize. You know, there are sort of, it's estimated that there are 3.4 million people who experience stalking, and it's estimated that 850,000 of those individuals are stalked via network technologies. Oh. So it's not an insignificant number of people who face, you know, threats online, privacy invasions, like the posting of their nude photos along with their contact information, you know, defamation that really makes it impossible to get a job, and ways in which they feel so silenced, individuals. It's often a perfect storm of all of those things.
Do you think for some people they say, well, it's just words, you know, it's just people kind of mouthing off, being obnoxious, but it doesn't really have an impact.
Right. And that's precisely what we are wrestling with. And it's true, sort of often that impulse to say, it's ones and zeros, just close your computer and ignore it. I mean, that also holds back, in some respect, law enforcement, local, you know, state and federal, from taking it seriously. Like, it's not a matter of national security. There's nothing we can do for you. And for victims, you know, they're terrified. They move. They substantially change their lives. They can't get jobs or they get fired from their jobs, and they're terrified. So I think we really wrestle with those social attitudes, much in the way, right, in the 60s and 70s, we said to women in the workplace, you don't like it? Go get another job. Go find another supervisor. And that's just an untenable thing to ask people today, like to say to a journalist, you can't be on Twitter, right? That is like, just bug off the internet. That's just infeasible for people today.
So should we have more criminal laws to try to police the internet for this stuff?
I think we need to enforce the laws that we have on the books today, right? So we have we have like a pretty terrific federal cyber stalking statute, which is well tailored, and we have state threat and stalking and harassment laws that we can enforce. And it's true that in about 40% of the states, harassment and stalking laws don't cover postings on third-party sites. Mm-hmm. So like you tweet a nude photo of someone and then send it to the person's employer. A harassment law, stalking law may not cover it because it's not sent directly to the victim, which seems kind of crazy. So in many respects, we do have to update our harassment and state stalking laws to sort of catch up with 21st century realities, because we can get stalked by a drone, by a spyware app. There are so many ways in which robots, right, we can stalk people, third-party sites, and it doesn't have to be sent directly to them, but it has the same net sort of profound effect on their lives.
And should we, when we think about this, is it important to think about nude photos, I guess, as an example of how someone's reputation can be, besmirched?
No, that's exactly right. So when a nude photo of someone who they shared in confidence and trust with someone they loved, that then is leaked to the internet and is prominent in a search of their name, it's often sort of taken and then their home address and Facebook posts, you know, their Facebook profile is kind of glommed onto it. There are revenge porn sites that are searchable by zip code. Right. So you go to your zip code. And you can find all the women in your zip code whose nude photos have been leaked online. And it's terrifying for victims because they fear that they're going to be confronted, you know, in person. And often they receive emails and texts suggesting that, hey, I'm interested in sex. I saw your nude photo and I saw that it said that you were interested in anonymous sex, which obviously they didn't write, but someone impersonated them.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Danielle Citron. She's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, and she's an expert in hate crimes and also privacy and some of the threats online related to things like nude photos and what can be done to protect people when it comes to those kinds of threats. And if you want to join the conversation, apparently our phones are now working. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Especially if this has been a problem or an issue for you, do give us a call. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Does law enforcement take this as seriously as you do?
You know, so we're working on it, right? So the Attorney General of California, Kamala Harris, has been sort of an extraordinary leader in taking on the issue, in nudging law enforcement to take harassment and the posting, as well as the posting of nude photos if it's not accompanied by other abuse, seriously. And so I'm working on a task force with the AG to help train law enforcement, to sort of give them a script about, hey, these are the potential crimes. This is how you can go about investigating them. And the AG is working on legislation to make sure that officers can get a warrant in cases involving the exploitation of nude photos. So there's definitely hope on the horizon. And there are terrific U.S. Attorney's Office that are especially in California, the Central District of California, that have brought cases under the federal cyberstalking statute. But unfortunately, I know these folks are almost like a handful of people across the country. And we want to spread the message that, you know, most victims, though, unfortunately, are turned away. And the advice is turn your computer off, ignore it, it'll go away. And that's just not advice that really people can internalize and have it work for them.
Is it that law enforcement just doesn't understand how, if you're the object or the, I guess the victim, if I can put it that way, of cyberstalking, just understand how frightening that is?
Right. And I think in part two, it's just a lack of understanding of the technology. It can be pretty intimidating, right? We know that, you know, even most parents of teenagers look at this technology and they bug out and they say, oh, I don't understand it. Right. It's beyond me. Right. I mean, most law enforcement, they're great at street crimes. This is new to them. So investigating, getting a warrant, figuring out how to go to an online service provider and then an ISP, getting a warrant, that's new to them. So I think in part it's training on the technology as well as the law. I'm not suggesting that law enforcement isn't sympathetic, but they really just need ample training in both the law and the tech.
Thinking about street crime, I mean, taking this example of nude photos, if someone were to, I guess, walk around on the street with a picture of a nude woman, will say, and sort of walk among the public. I mean, is that sort of a more analog way to think about how intrusive that can be?
And what's interesting, too, is that I would imagine that law enforcement, if they saw a nude photo of a private individual, not a public individual, let's say posted in a store front with her home address and said she's for a good time call, I can't imagine law enforcement would say that's not serious. And what's interesting is that when posted online, it's even more damaging because the number of eyeballs and people who see it, share it, and then can run with it, glom onto it, post, you know, other additional information that can be even more damaging, like the suggestion someone's interested in rape and where they live. So there's a real disconnect, I think, in this education of ways in which we can harm each other online.
You mentioned public figures. You actually referenced Congressman Weiner. I mean, that was a different thing because he was posting his own photos of himself online.
Yep. Right. And so the idea that we would punish the press for posting his tweets that he sent to someone of his, oh, let's just say underwear, for being sort of safe. You know, I think that we might and would clearly say we're not going to prosecute the press, right? If we have a well-crafted revenge porn or a sexual invasion of privacy statute, we shouldn't and can't because the press didn't sort of breach confidence, right? They didn't knowingly invade someone's privacy. And crucially, it's a matter of public interest. Like, do we want to know? Should we vote for this person for mayor? But the typical person who faces harassment is truly the everyday person, the doctor, the nurse, the grad student, the teacher. You know, it's the everyday person who experiences it rather than the public figure.
As I mentioned earlier, and I think for our listeners' sake as well, just knowing how potentially common this is, and also the fact that you've referenced that, you know, workforce harassment was kind of poo-pooed a number of, well, let's say, a generation or so ago.
Right. It's just not that long ago, if you think about it.
It isn't that long ago. But now it's taken much more seriously. I mean, if you work at a place, there are all sorts of rules about harassment at work.
That's right. And it's really fundamentally changed workplaces, right? The person who worked in the 1970s, I feel like we could talk about the show Mad Men. You know,
We could talk about the show Mad Men.
Right? Yes. It was a very different set of social norms. And law played a big role, and its enforcement of Title VII played a big role in changing how we saw and understood sexual harassment. It was educative. And I think the law can be here, too. We can understand the internet and network tools as fundamental to our work lives, right, and our social lives and our political lives, our civic engagement, right? If we're forced and shoved offline, we can't engage as digital citizens. So I think we are in that educative moment, right? We need to teach people. And law can help us a little bit, but these kinds of conversations help, too.
What about people's First Amendment rights? I mean, how do you factor something like that in? And people have the right to say all sorts of horrible things.
That's right. They have every right under the First Amendment to say offensive, rude, and hateful speech. But there are certain categories of speech that we say are so harmful and contribute so little to public discourse that we don't protect that kind of speech, or it's given really negligible protection. And that includes the defamation of private individuals. True threats. And we talked last time I was on about aloneness, and we're going to, you know, hear from the Supreme Court about what's required to show a true threat. But nonetheless, true threats do not enjoy First Amendment protection. Breaches of confidence fall out of, they don't have First Amendment salience. You can contract around the First Amendment. And crime facilitating speech like solicitation and extortion, which is often what these revenge porn operators are engaged in, that is, they urge people to post nude photos and then charge for their takedown. It's a crime. Right. Intentional infliction of emotional distress of private people about purely private matters gets less rigorous protection. So much of the harassment I'm talking about, and I'm really careful about the First Amendment, falls within categories of speech that receives either no protection or less rigorous protection, and we can prosecute it.
And since the Supreme Court is going to be ruling on this case, and we're in Pennsylvania here, can you give us bit of a snapshot about what's at stake here?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court is wrestling with the question, under the First Amendment, in order to show and prove a true threat and therefore prosecute a threat, a terroristic threat, the question is whether the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant intended to terrorize the victim, or rather whether it's sufficient under the First Amendment that that an objective person would understand, either from the defendant's perspective or the victim's, that it was a threat of a physical violence that is meant to terrorize. Mm. So,
and this is a Pennsylvania couple, right?
Right. It sort of comes out of the Alonis case, comes out of a domestic violence dispute where the defendant was terrorizing his ex-wife on Facebook. And sort of ultimately, I mean, he says he's going to cut her head off, throw her head in the river. He posts on her sister's page, right? So it's really meant to get to her. And it's really only after there's a protective order in place that he starts saying, oh, it's rap music, right? He's convicted of a threat. He served his time. So really the question before the court is going to establish precedent. I hope they directly take on the question, right, of what do we need to show a true threat? Is it enough to say that an objective person, reasonable person, would understand it as a terroristic threat? Or do we need to show, in order to give breathing room for speech, to ensure that we're not chilling speech, do we need to show an intent to terrorize?
Well, we're almost out of time here. And I mean, the First Amendment, all this stuff is so fascinating because the way it intersects and technology obviously kind of ramping some of this stuff up.
Right. I mean, so the internet has ones and zeros if you really think about it, right? So that so often the mantra on the internet in the early years was all information has to be free. And the idea that we would bring law into this space was almost somewhat heretical to suggest that. So in the early years of my work, I got a lot of pushback.
I bet you did.
Right. It said, Danielle, you're an enemy of the First Amendment, when in fact I'm a huge fan.
Well, on that
note, want to protect.
On that note, Danielle Citron, nice to have you with us.
Thank you for
in
me.
Studio on Radio Times. Again, she's a professor of law at the University of Maryland. Wrote a book last year called Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. She contributed a chapter to a new book called Privacy in the Modern Age. And in about an hour at noon today, she'll be at the National Constitution Center across the street from WHYY here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, and how to follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.